Matt Kibbe here, host of Kibbe on Liberty. We are at the New Hampshire Liberty Forum, hosted by my friends at the Free State Project. We're going to talk a little bit about politics. We're going to talk about social change. We're going to talk about policy and this beautiful community that is rising up in the Granite State, defending and fighting for liberty. Check it out. Glenn, what on earth brings you up north to the Granite State? What are you doing up here?
It's the New Hampshire Liberty Forum here in the Free State. I'm really looking forward. I'm speaking that. I'm really looking forward to it. And also catching up some old friends.
Yeah. It feels like home to me. Like, I've been coming to Porkfest for, I think, maybe 15 years now. This is my first Liberty Forum. But it's cool. Even though I don't know most of the people here, I just feel at home.
Yeah.
And it feels it's my safe space.
Yeah. Exactly. I've never been to Porkfest. This is my second or third Liberty Forum, though. So I've just never been able to make it up for the Porkfest event. But yeah, I feel the same way. And again, you know, getting to meet people that I might follow on social media or that I know do some pretty cool things. It's just neat to be able to connect with those folks in person.
Yeah, it's a fascinating model of social change, and I'm all for like 10, 20, 1,000 different projects, because we don't actually know how to best protect liberty except vigilance. And one of the things they're doing here is just 100% bottom up. And you have a lot of activists who become state legislators. They have a huge legislature here. And to me, it's what the American system was supposed to look like. And in New Hampshire, where you can actually bump into your legislator at the coffee shop, you can actually have a conversation.
I think every state rep represents 3,000 people. Contrast that to a U.S. congressman whose district is about 750,000 people. So really, for better or for worse, actually, this is a great example of much more democratic system.
Yeah.
Than we've seen in Washington, D.C. It's a lot like Switzerland, frankly.
You bring up the D word, and Tulsi Gabbard spoke this morning, and we were talking about her before. There is this thing, and she said this, there's this thing like, weirdly, tragically, today, when someone invokes our democracy, you know they mean exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
They're trying to figure out a way to ensure that the people don't have a voice in some big government scheme they're cooking up.
Exactly. You know, and nowadays when I hear protect democracy, what they're really talking about is protecting the interest of the left wing.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about. Anyone who opposes that. And one of the things that's really disconcerting to me is how when we would think about liberals, you know, there were things that I would agree with them on, such as free speech. And now they've become the worst about censorship. And they've become the worst about the ultimate goal is power and staying in power, right? And when I think of democracy, and obviously, you know, we're a republic, but we are a democratic. Our system of government is a republic, but our system of elections is democracy. And when I say that, it's, you know, the people here and the representatives here, because they represent such a limited number of people, they can actually understand what the folks here think, as opposed to, you know, if you have your U.S. congressman, he's in Washington, D.C., he ain't listening to you.
Yeah.
You know, and unfortunately, most of them spent most of their time in D.C., so they're hanging out with lobbyists instead of back home, hanging out with the people who actually sent them there to do the job. So yes, there is a distinct difference between how I would use democracy and how a lot of people on the left are now using the term.
I like to retake these words that are rich in their original meaning. The phrase democracy to me means, and I'll keep rehabilitating this term, because I think going back to the founders and our constitutional republic and the constitutional constraints on government, they all said, George Washington, most famously, the sacred fire of liberty is dependent on people.
Right.
And people being responsible and educated and vigilant. And to me, that's what democracy is. It's people actually spending enough time to pay enough attention to know that their government's out of control. And then the question is, what do we do with these tools that we have?
Right, exactly.
It can be frustrating because you mentioned members of Congress. They're completely insulated from people, and they're surrounded by consultants and lobbyists and an echo chamber that says, yeah, one more war. Yeah, let's another trillion in debt. It's fine.
Yeah. No, that's a huge problem. Also, you know, just whatever special interest group that has talked to them most recently or given them the most money. There are some great people in Congress. My congressman, Tim Burchett, I think does a fantastic job. Tim hates Washington, D.C. He would so much rather be in East Tennessee than he would Washington. And I think that's why, you know, we're seeing a lot of turnover now in Congress is because you either get sucked into the machine or you get just completely disgusted and leave.
Yeah. Right?
And it shouldn't be that way, but unfortunately that's what the system has produced at this point. And I think that we've seen that as over time, you know, think about this. We've gone from George Washington, one of the greatest figures in world history as president, to Joe Biden. That tells you something, Sean.
I did not watch the State of the Union, but apparently he just was like shouting at the sky.
He was the angry old man. And of course, the folks on the left, his apologists, oh, that was great. He showed that he was strong and, you know, and assertive. And again, what he really showed is it looked like an angry old man who was just ticked off at the world. And instead of unifying, it was just another wedge. And I don't even watch any of that stuff anymore either. Yeah, I'll read it just to see what happened. But it gets so tiring. And it's also, I'm really tired of always hearing how I'm the problem in the
right
country because, you know, I don't agree with the left on a lot of these things. And because of that, I become the problem instead of taking different perspectives and saying, hey, you got a point here. How can we work together to make this better? Literally now it's just my team's going to win and we're going to smash everybody else.
Yeah. It's, and I think both parties are guilty of this, but Biden is a tremendous example of diverting attention away from like what I would have wanted to hear about is the state of the economy and the state of people's pocketbooks and whether or not things are getting better or worse. But the political class loves to divide us based on just like we hate those guys. And that's the only reason we're showing up is to fight fellow Americans who we disagree with. I'm guessing like there's a different vibe in Knox County.
Yeah, there is. And I think that's, I can't say about every place, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's probably much more true at the local level. That's even changed, though, since I've been in office for going on 6 years now. When I first came in, a lot of the issues that were federal issues and the really divisive things, you know, we didn't have to deal with them, didn't talk about. Well, now you have more and more folks that are, that's become their focus. And one of the frustrating things just doing the business of local government is like, I can't do anything about those things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's not in my purview.
Have you been asked to take a position on Palestine?
No, not on that. You know, things like that. Not really. It's just, you know, a lot of the social issues.
Yeah, so, okay.
Then the foreign policy. And, you know, and that's what folks are concentrating on. And it's like, that's not really what we do at the local level. So things have even changed in local politics, I think, over the past several years, not for the better.
Yeah, it's some kind of an infection or something. And I think we all saw it creeping into the public conversation, but the thing that seemed to just turbocharge the hate and divisiveness for me were the lockdowns.
Right.
And in a certain sense, I get this because then it became like the rhetoric was so heated and people that thought that shutting down the economy sounded a little bit crazy, started asking questions and they immediately get demonized in the worst possible way. Like if you suggest that shutting down the entire economy might hurt poor people, you were immediately accused of killing grandma.
Yep. Oh, I know. Because you were accused of that.
How many grandmas did you kill?
You know, here's the thing is COVID is a serious issue, right? It's a serious health issue. We all realize that. And now more and more looking like it was a serious health issue caused in part by our own government.
Yeah.
We were funding gain-of-function research in China, thanks to Dr. Fauci, who at one point was the patron saint of big government. I don't want to diminish the tragedy that, you know, COVID caused in human suffering as far as the disease itself. At the same time, we, through our response as a country, and in many cases at state and local, we really just amplified that. And instead of doing focus protection and saying, yeah, this is something that's dangerous for older folks, they need to beware, they need to take precautions, but everybody else needs to live their lives. Instead, it just became basically an excuse for the government to, I believe, launch one of the biggest takeovers in our history, and one of the biggest threats to our individual liberty and our economic freedom that we have ever seen. And people were so wrapped up either between the fear or the tribalism that they couldn't see the long-term effect that this was going to have. And the long-term effect of the loss of freedom, the economic devastation, what we did by not allowing our kids to be educated, the issues with mental health. You know, I saw an article the other day about how excess deaths due to alcoholism has spiked.
Yeah.
You know, in, I believe it was April 2020, we had a rash of suicides in Knox County. And that's when they first started talking about doing lockdowns. And I was like, I think that these suicides might have something to do with all this rhetoric about isolation and economic hardship. And I was told, no, that's not the case. And data doesn't back up what you're saying, because these people didn't leave suicide notes, despite the fact that the vast majority of suicide victims do not leave notes. And basically, it was just a hit job to say, oh, no, the mayor's crazy and out of his mind. Turns out that I was right.
Yeah.
I was right about a lot of that stuff. And I'm not because I'm smart, it's because common sense. And what we did is we really just took the nation onto a very bad path. And now the amazing thing to me is everybody just kind of wants to move on and forget about it. No, we need to hold some people accountable, because they hurt a lot of folks and they hurt our country.
Free the People is embarking on our most ambitious project to date to document and expose the lies behind the greatest public health failure in my lifetime. We're talking to insiders with firsthand knowledge of the government's role in funding, creating, and then covering up the COVID-19 virus in our exclusive new documentary series, The Cover-Up. But I need your help. We won't get to the bottom of this scandal alone, so I'm asking viewers to crowdsource any information that could be helpful to our investigation. If you're watching this, you already know what the government did during lockdowns was unforgivable. Help us get to the truth and prevent it from ever happening again. To get involved, go to freethepeople.org/coverup. That's freethepeople.org/coverup. The truth is out there.
The CDC took that study about the shocking rise in alcohol-related deaths and immediately try not to say tweet anymore, because yeah. I appreciate
Twitter.
I appreciate what Elon's trying to do, but they're on X scolding us about we're drinking too much. And I'm like, dude, you did this.
Yeah.
Single institution more than the CDC is responsible for, like you said, these are common sense things. You can't take humans and lock them down.
We're social creatures. Yeah. You can't just tell people you have to stay at home and you can't work for a living and you can't send your kids to school.
Yeah.
That's just dystopian, well, beyond anything you'd ever read in Orwell or a Huxley or anything like that. It was one of the very worst things and one of the very worst public policy decisions that has ever been made, not only history of the United States, the history of the world.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think, so one time we were talking, and I think you had the charming opportunity to meet Deborah Birx, didn't she? Didn't she travel to Tennessee to tell you to keep up the lockdown?
Yeah, she did. She was actually doing a tour of Southeastern Conference schools. So again, our local media, upon hearing that she was going to come to Knoxville, is going, oh my gosh, you know, things are so terrible here that Deborah Birx is coming. No, she was just, it was a routine thing that she was doing. But yeah, we were in a room at the University of Tennessee in one of their conference rooms, which it was a huge room, and we're all sitting there wearing masks, sitting 25 feet apart to the point to where you couldn't hear each other talk. And the great thing about the masks, and this always just make me laugh, is when people would take their mask off to talk, well, the mask is supposed to prevent spittle.
Right.
And then you take it off to talk because no one can hear you. So anyway, we're in this room. I'm the only person in the room that doesn't have a PhD or an MD. Okay. So these are really smart folks. And she said that someone asked her, what should we do? And she said, you need to shut down your bars and your restaurants, especially those close to the campus here. And to their credit, one of the people with a PhD or an MD said, well, Dr. Birx, the data shows that it's not spreading in bars and restaurants. And Matt, she said, she's a scientist. She's data driven. Okay, it's all about the science, follow the science. She said, well, that's true, but we need to send a message that this is serious. I'm sitting in a room of very smart people who are all wearing masks as they're scared to death.
Yeah.
And she's talking about a public relations campaign.
Yeah.
And turns out, if you've ever, did you read Scott Atlas's book?
Yeah.
And he talks about that and how literally she was getting, you know, we think of government and, you know, we have the ability to gather all this data and all these studies, which in some cases we do. She was just pulling from publicly available stuff and was not taking into account that, you know, the government didn't have to do all these mitigation efforts because people were doing them themselves. I was talking with a friend of mine who's one of the good economists at the University of Tennessee, and he's a free market guy. And he talked about how 75% of the economic activity that dropped during COVID actually occurred before all the lockdowns and everything because people were
adapting.
Yeah, they were adapting. Now, obviously, that was going to go back up, so they weren't going to do that forever. But nevertheless, people were listening. People were taking it seriously. But to Deborah Birx, you had to go through this theater to basically show 300 million children, 350 million children across the United States that this is a serious issue.
One of my obsessions, informed by my love of Friedrich Hayek and Frederick Bastiat from early March, I was just thinking about local knowledge versus central planning. And this is a great example of people in communities, let's say in the hospital system in a local community, would obviously have better knowledge about how to manage a crisis, a change in health status, whatever that is. But, you know, the governors, infamously the governor of New York, said, I know better, and ended up killing a bunch of seniors in the process.
Yeah, sending people who were infected with COVID into nursing homes, which is the absolute worst thing that you ever could have done.
Yeah.
Right?
Which, by the way, should have been obvious. You don't need to be a doctor to know this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you actually do see the stats and you realize, and we knew it early on, who the vulnerable population was. Yeah. That's pretty common sense again. But, you know, again, so many of these things, they were coming from the CDC, and the public health officials were just parroting what the CDC said. So you literally had, it was all top down coming from the highest levels. And now, you know, you go back and no one knows where the 6-foot rule came from. Where'd that come from? Well, we don't know. You know, the mask was based on one study from a hair salon in Springfield, Illinois. Okay. That's where all the stuff about mandatory masking came from. And the best that you could say about that study was it was anecdote, right? There was no control group. There was nothing you would see in the scientific study. It was just these people wore masks and supposedly they didn't get as high a rate of COVID as other people did, but you couldn't measure that because you didn't have your control group, because you're basically relying on a survey. Right. And all of these things. But that became, I mean, I heard that from my own public health people. The Springfield study. I was like, it's not even a study. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a doctor. And I'm looking at this going, This is, if I were judging a junior high school science fair project, they'd have been gone because they didn't have a control group and they weren't even doing a real study.
Yeah. Well, there's, you mentioned Scott Atlas's book, Plague on Our House. I just reread it because we may do something with that. But there's the more interesting chapter. I mean, a lot of stories about Scott Atlas actually quoting data, actually quoting studies, actually having read all of this stuff, and no one else at the COVID task force right. in the White House had either read this stuff or comprehended what he was saying to them. And there's one particular chapter where he says that the COVID task force eventually devolved into a PR meeting.
Right.
Like, what's the message? How are we going to keep people doing this stuff, even though there wasn't any science behind what they were asking people to do?
Yeah. And apparently Deborah Birx has released a memoir.
Yeah.
I think. And that she admits that
yeah.
in there, that, you know, the 15 days to flatten the curve all along, that was just a Trojan horse to bring the lockdown.
Yeah.
She knew that from the very start.
Yeah.
And then she admits it in a book. I don't necessarily know if I'd admit that in public, but she did.
It's a noble lie.
Yeah, I guess. And then, unfortunately, there's a lot of those
yeah.
that have been thrown out over the past several years.
I am obsessed with this question. And I'm actually working with Scott Atlas, Jay Bhattacharya.
Oh, great.
Of the Great Barrington Declaration, Senator Rand Paul. I'm doing an investigative series called The Cover-Up because I'm honestly trying to understand how something this big and catastrophic could have happened, because all of these mistakes, you can tabulate the cost based on bodies, people that died because we took the wrong approach. And you know, you hear all these stories now where she admits that she was lying and Fauci says, oh, six feet, we just made that up. Part of it has to be that the people that were culpable for Wuhan and gain of function and the accidental release of this very dangerous virus, are they diverting attention? What exactly are they covering up?
Well, I would say when it comes to that particular question about the origin of the virus, absolutely. It's all CYA. I mean, you know, you don't want to be responsible for it. And look, I don't think that it was intentional or delivered by any stretch of the imagination. But nevertheless, you were doing very dangerous experiment, which you shouldn't have been doing.
Yeah.
And those things should have never happened. And our government should not have been funding those. Okay. So yeah, obviously as a human being, you don't want to be responsible for that. And then you think about, you go from being the most listened to person in America to maybe having a hand in the whole, the origins of the whole thing. I wouldn't want to be in that spot. So yeah, I think that's what it all is, whether it's CYA, whether it's deflecting, you know, I think a lot of it with, the departments of the federal government is they saw huge increases in their fiefdom and inflated their budgets. And what bureaucrat doesn't want that?
Yeah.
Again, I'm not saying that that was their conscious thought, but unfortunately that's the unintended consequence
yeah.
of all this. So we all owe Senator Rand Paul a huge debt of gratitude because he has been the person that's been spearheading and actually talking about these things, which otherwise they would have already gone down the memory hole. You know, I remember what I was talking about. Well, there's a possibility this could have been a lab leak. Oh my gosh, you're a conspiracy theorist.
Right.
You know, Fauci says, well, then it turns out Fauci had actually squashed any questions about it. And people on his own staff were saying, man, this looks bad. This thing could have been the cause of human intervention in the virus, right? And then like a day later, all of a sudden, they were all singing off the same sheet of paper.
Yep.
How does that
happen? Yeah. He controls a big pot of money.
Well, yeah, when you control billions of dollars,
yeah.
you can get everybody to say what you want them to say.
At Kibbe on Liberty, freedom is a lifestyle 24/7, something you live and breathe and wear every day. If that describes you, you need the very best Liberty swag in the market today. just like this shirt I happen to be wearing. Go to freethepeople.org/KOL and check out our exciting merch. You too can love liberty and look cool.
But just like, I just want people to appreciate that it's more than harmless bureaucratic butt covering, because he diverted the entire world response away from, like, if we had known it was gain of function, we would have known the origins, we would have known how to deal with it best. But treating that as a conspiracy theory and squashing that literally cost lives.
Well, everything from an economic perspective, and having, instead of utilizing limited resources where they could have been most used and most appropriate, which would have been that focus protection, okay, older folks, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, things like that. Instead of focusing on that, we just, you know, threw it all across the entire society. We wasted huge amounts of resources, deprived the market of its ability to produce more resources, and, you know, we basically just crowded out all the efforts which should have been focused on the people that could have been helped the most. So not only did the virus itself, in my opinion, not only did it end up taking a huge toll on older folks and vulnerable people because of the virus, but also because you have all these other people eating up hospital resources, eating up all these other things, those folks couldn't get the care that they need.
Yeah.
Which, that's a tragedy in itself.
Yeah. So we've established the loss of civil liberties, which is incalculable. We've established the loss of lives, which is incalculable. But the other thing that happened, and also the loss of civility, because I do think that there was a tipping point with lockdowns where we all got a little more angry at each other, obviously, because we're being told we're not essential.
Right.
We're locked into our houses.
Right.
But the other... And
the resentment. I mean, I don't really like being called some of the murder gravel. I'm sorry. Humanity rejects that, but I don't care about other people.
You're just being sensitive.
I guess. But, you know, all the time I was told, I'm putting the economy over people. I'm putting profits over people, right? But the economy is people. And if people don't have the ability to produce, don't have the ability to make a living, they're going to die.
Yeah.
That is just the fact of the matter. And for that, I was castigated. And as you said, you know, accused of literally murdering grandma, and all I was trying to do was just ensure that people had, you know, a job to go to.
Yeah.
Right.
Jay Bhattacharya tells a story of, you know, his mom grew up in Calcutta, one of the poorest parts of India, one of the poorest parts in the world. And he's keenly aware of I'll call it the end of the supply chain, but the people at the margins are clinging to the last rung of the economic ladder. And for them, you shut down any part of the economy, and suddenly they can't sell X number of coconuts so that they can feed their family that day. There is no cushion.
Right.
And it's not about the laptop class that they could just hang out and be comfortable.
I mean, they could say, hey, we're all in this together. It's great. I get to order my food from wherever and it gets delivered. Well, you completely destroyed the hospitality industry. Okay. As you said, it wasn't the more fluent people that were harmed. In fact, they didn't feel anything other than the inconvenience.
Right.
I mean, you see these videos, oh my gosh, it's so bad, I'm standing all alone in my mansion.
And my Uber Eats is cold.
And watching Netflix all day long.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, what about the single mom who was a waitress before, who has no way now of making ends meet? You know, other than now, you know, then we start giving people bunches of money, which all he did that was cause inflation and didn't make up for the economic loss they felt. Well, what about her kids then? Okay. What about her kids who are no longer going to school and who will feel that for a lifetime because they're not getting the education that they need? You know, yes, so you're exactly right. And there was a huge bifurcation of the afford, the laptop class.
Dare we say haves and have nots?
The haves, nots, you know, and you know, here I am, people will say, well, you know, you're one of those mean, cold-hearted Republicans who doesn't care about poor people. No, you hurt poor people worst of all with what you did. with this. And again, you know, people like me and many others, and you and many others, we were making that point, but it didn't matter.
Yeah.
These folks are comfortable doing what they're doing. They could empathize and realize that not everybody was in that situation.
Before lockdowns, we would often, whenever we would get together, either on camera or off, we'd talk about the growing debt and the fiscal time bomb and the way that the Fed monetizes debt and all this. But and by no means were either Republicans or Democrats not guilty. Yeah. It was a bipartisan effort to run up the debt clock, and
right.
And somewhere along the way, the Tea Party ethos of fiscal responsibility disappeared, and something else happened. But come lockdowns, and a shout out to Thomas Massie is the one member of Congress that insisted that they actually show up on that first $2 trillion bailout bill. We're now spending trillions of dollars like it's candy. And I just looked this up. Bank of America just did a study. You probably saw this, that every 100 days, we add another $1 trillion to the national debt. We've been saying, like, I know you love the Austrian economists and all that. We've been saying for a long time, this is unsustainable. But we're like in Argentina territory at this point.
There's a number of issues with the whole debt situation. Yeah, what, $34.5 trillion, I think, is where we're at now. As you said, it's hard to keep track of because it's just...
I almost don't pay attention anymore because it makes me sad.
And it's hard for people to wrap their mind around because these are such large numbers that they're completely abstract. And it's never going to get paid off. We understand that. But the most important thing, actually, and we do this at the local level, okay? It's, for us... You know, your absolute amount of debt is one thing. Maybe the more important number is your debt service, okay? And can you pay that, okay? Because like in Knox County, we're growing, okay? If we don't raise taxes, but we still have to build stuff, we do have to take outs. We do have to do that, unfortunately. But just like when you take out a mortgage, can you pay it back? That's the important thing, okay? When you look at the federal government, last year, they spent over $700 billion on debt service. It will soon be the single largest item in the federal budget because not only has the amount of debt gone up, but interest rates have gone up as well. So previously, we were spending, I think, about 2.15% was the average interest rate that the federal government was paying. That's up to 4%. It's doubled. So we're going to be seeing $1.5, $2 trillion in interest payments, which is a budget buster. And at some point, you just start monetizing the debt where you're just taking out more debt to pay the interest payments, right? Well, the other problem with that is a national security issue. Because if I'm China and I'm Russia, I'm going, well, the dollar's weak. And that's what they've been doing, actually. That's what Putin has been doing in Russia, is I'm going to start charging other countries. They're going to have to pay for my natural gas in rubles. Or if I'm China, my partners in Sino-Asia are going to have to pay for Chinese goods in yuan. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to institute regional reserve currencies. You know, the dollar is not going to probably, I say this and it might not be true, well, unless the petrodollar fails. In that case, we're done. But, you know, the dollar... It's just slowly losing its status. What I mean by status is the amount of reserves kept around the world are slowly draining of dollars. And the Russians and the Chinese are replacing those with their own currencies. And the problem for us is the reason we haven't seen actually rampant inflation at rates we couldn't imagine is because we export so much of it, right? You know, other countries buy our debt. Well, if they're not have an appetite for dollars, if it switches to yuan and rubles, all that money stays here. And you want to talk about an inflationary environment, you know, that's what we're going to be in. So you have the debt, the interest payments on the debt, you have the reserve currency status, all these things are coming together. And as you said, it's become a snowball. And every 3 months, the snowball just gets exponentially bigger. And it's not going to stop anytime soon.
And the degradation of the dollar.
Yes.
and the printing presses and the the expansion of the money supply.
And, yes. And then you have these lunatics with their modern monetary theory thinking that debt doesn't matter, that printing money doesn't matter, doesn't have any impact. You know, meanwhile, we see these high inflation rates. And of course, those are kind of bogus as well, because they'll take out food. Everything that actually costs more money, food and energy, they remove that from their inflation numbers. They can say, oh, it's only 3.5%. Well, then too, it's 3.5% above a much higher baseline than we had 3 or 4 years ago.
Thank you for joining me today on Kibbe on Liberty and for being part of our fiercely independent audience. Every week, my organization, Free the People, partners with Blaze TV to bring you this show. My guests bring smart perspectives on everything from current events to timeless philosophical debates. If you like what you hear, go to freethepeople.org/KOL and support Kibbe on Liberty so we can continue to produce these honest conversations with interesting people. Now, let's get back to it.
Yeah. And so few voices in Congress are actually willing to say what you just said.
Yeah.
So like, I don't see any interest or will, like, you know, there, you know, this handful of liberty legislators that actually will fight for these things. But it's a very lowly fight. And one of the Achilles heels of the Republican Party is fully funding. Well, they used to be fully funding the war on terror. And now it's just this sort of expansionary foreign policy where we're just throwing money at problems and we're everywhere doing everything. This is how empires die.
And I would actually correct you maybe just a little bit, because some of the most outspoken voices on that, Rand and then others, you know, within the Freedom Caucus, wherever,
yeah,
they're the ones talking about that.
Right.
You know, and the reason, and, you know, meanwhile, it's almost like in 20 years ago, you're exactly right. I think now it's almost switched a little bit to now where it's the Democrats that are, oh my gosh, you know, we have to spend all this money in Ukraine. You know, we have to spend all
Nancy Pelosi. Yeah.
And again, you know, meanwhile, where are we getting this money from? Well, we're getting it. We're not even taxing or borrowing. We're printing it. And that's the worst possible thing you could actually do. So yes, at some point we have to take a very strong look at all the foreign aid flows out of this country. And we're seeing foreign aid to countries that have less debt than we do per capita.
Yeah.
You know, and as a percentage of the budget. You know, we've become the world's piggy bank, we've become the world's policeman. So we supply American boys and girls and money. You know, maybe when I'll tell you a story. When Donald Trump was elected, I was actually in the UK. This is in 2016, I guess, right? And I'm watching Sky News, which is kind of their version of CNN, Fox, and they are going just apoplectic because this guy's talking about pulling out of NATO. Matt, they go, who's going to defend Europe? And I went, maybe Europe should defend Europe. But that is, you know, the world is now, or the West anyway, has gotten so used to the U.S. footing the bill, both treasury and lives, that, you know, that's the entire issue with NATO, is the fact that I was reading an article today, you know, of how literally NATO looks, the U.S. has become NATO, as opposed to the people that actually, you know, back the most, which are the European countries. You know, they look to us to send all the money and at some point to send our boys and girls. And this is another one that hits real close to my heart. The one of the 13 service members who was the last casualties in Afghanistan was an Osceola County boy. You know, I think to myself, I'm like, you know, yeah, we should have ended that war. Absolutely. Should have been gone. Should have ended a long, long time ago. The withdrawal was disastrous. The way that it was, you know, tactically, it was terrible. But the same people that were in charge of that are still in charge, and they want to start other wars around the globe.
Yeah,
with our boys and girls. That is a hard no for me.
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be much accountability, and even like the withdrawal of Afghanistan, which, and I would have been one of the ones to say don't even go in, but
right. Yeah,
and I've been clamoring for 20 years,
yes,
as you probably have, to get out.
And for me, it's like, you got Bin Laden. Why are we still there for another 10 years?
One of the questions I've obsessed about, and I'm friends with Glenn Beck, and you may know Glenn organized privately funded planes to rescue Christians from Afghanistan because the exit was so catastrophically executed. It almost feels like planned chaos to me. Like, surely, like, you guys surely had an exit strategy that you had worked out to the very details for years going into this, because Trump was talking about this for his entire term. And then they just
abandoned that and just haphazard, chaotic, whatever that was.
And I can't help but wonder if the Liz Cheneys of the world wanted to tell the story. See, if we had never left, this horrible tragedy wouldn't have happened. Or it could just be that government fails even when you need it to perform its most basic functions.
Yeah, for me, it became very personal.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I look at, oh, we need to go into here, we need to go into there, I said, no, we don't. We just don't. And we need to quit spending the money, and we need to quit putting on boys and girls.
Well, I was talking with one of the guys here that's leading the efforts to defend the Guard and make sure that the National Guard is not deployed in unconstitutional wars. A statement of the obvious, and you can see how many veterans have, you know, starting with rallying around Ron Paul, but rallying around the idea that the government has to stop getting involved in so many things without a mission, without a purpose, without any constitutional authority. And it strikes me that it's always true that the people that start these wars never pay the price. It's the people that fight. And it's two different classes of people.
It's better for the have and have nots.
There is no overlap.
Right. Meanwhile, you have the military-industrial complex who is just making huge, obscene amounts of money. And they're also in there stirring and doing everything they can to make sure that the gravy train keeps going. You know, one of the things, again, and going back to the hypocrisy of the left, you know, the fact that, oh, we need to keep on spending all this money in Russia because it actually comes back to the U.S. in the form of defense contractors. Well, guess what? That ain't going into mom and pop's pocketbook. That ain't going into the pocketbook of poor people. That's going into the pocketbook of the executives of those countries, our those companies, right? And then how can you say that we are willing to essentially kill people so that these people can make a profit? But you're compassionate and you care about folks? I don't think so.
Yeah, it's a lie.
Yeah. It's terrible.
It's a lie.
I just think that's one of the absolute worst, most uncompassionate, most hypocritical narratives that I've ever heard. It's actually very offensive.
Yeah.
I guess I'm being sensitive again, though.
No, it's unspeakably offensive.
It is.
There aren't the right words that we can use on this program, although sometimes I say them anyway.
We only went back at the State of the Union where he said he was dropping the F-bomb and said,
yeah,
the State of the Union.
There's no other words, right? At some point, you gotta pull out an F-bomb. Yeah. It's the only way to talk about it.
Unfortunately.
One more issue on have and have nots to sort of tie that knot. All of those checks, all the free money that we gave to people that weren't allowed to work, and this is something that Massey made the point of from day one, that was all monetized by printing funny money, which literally steals the dollars out of the working man's wallet. Again, like, if you're rich enough, you know how to hedge against inflation. You have a portfolio, you have managers, you have lawyers, and all that. But if you're just working, trying to put food on the table, and people have noticed, like, when you go to the grocery store now, you can't buy what you used to. And you know, Biden was bragging about how inflation's under control. It's like, you are never, ever going to convince anybody who actually goes to a grocery store with your cooked data about inflation, because that also is a lie,
right?
And this should be like, you know, I think we sometimes struggle as people that talk about economic realities to you said, like, when you were accused of putting the economy in front of lives, but all of these issues are about lives.
They are.
all of these issues are about poor people who aren't going to make it if you keep stealing their money.
That's right. Yeah, those $1,300 checks were the most expensive check you've ever gotten, because that's exactly what happened. And that, in the end, they printed trillions of dollars to pay for that. And what that does is that degrades the value of the money that's already in your pocket. And you're exactly right. More affluent people actually like inflation, because they'll see their portfolio go up. You know, they get the money before everybody else does, and they get to invest it. You know, so you have different kind of a timeline of inflation. The first part of inflation is great, because all, you know, your investments and your assets go up. The problem is then eventually it works its way into prices. Well, if you're one of the people that doesn't have those investments, doesn't have that ability, you don't get to partake in the first part. You only get when the prices go up. And obviously, you don't have the discretionary income and the ability to offset those higher prices with more money in the bank or money in the investment portfolio. So inflation, you know, inflation is a hidden tax, and it hurts poor people and especially people in fixed income the worst.
It's almost as regressive as never-ending war.
Yes.
And again, the people that do it never pay the price.
Yeah.
For the damage they cause. I want to switch subjects completely and wrap up with a report from the home front. How is Knox County? Is it still free and prosperous?
We are free and prosperous. We get impacted by all those things as well. You know, we're talking about inflation. That causes the burden on us, because you know, we have some talented people that do important work for the county. And we have other folks in the private sector that want to take them. They can pay more, you know? So we do the best that we can trying to take care of those folks. We have to pay for gasoline. We have to pay for diesel fuel. We have to pay for asphalt. And we can't print money to do that like the feds do. So that's one of the unfortunate things about the inflationary environment as well, is states and especially local governments also have, we're impacted just as the average person out there is. You know, and man, if I had my own printing press, I could really do some cool projects in Knox County, but we don't. And because of that, you know, we've been fiscally responsible through the years, but it puts a strain on us as well.
Yeah. This quaint idea that you have to live within your means.
Yeah. It becomes harder and harder when, you know, just everything is squeezed and, you know, we live within our means as much as we possibly can. But just like your household, when you're out there paying twice as much for groceries, it impacts us as well. And, you know, we have to be more and more creative in how we deal with that. And we've been able to do that. But nevertheless, it just makes things kind of uncomfortable for us, because, yeah, you know, we do have some functions that we're required to do by the state, and obviously that our citizens demand from us, and it gets harder and harder to provide those because everything's so much more expensive, right? And the reason for that is not because what we're doing, it's because of what Washington, D.C.
Okay, hear me out.
Sure.
Kane, 2028, when are you going to run for president?
I'm never going to run for president.
You're too sane.
Well, I would go insane in Washington, D.C. I don't know how people like Tim Burchett and Massey and Rand, Mike Lee, you know, I don't know how a lot of the good guys do it. I'm glad they're there, but I don't know how they do it. And I don't think that I could. And I really believe that as I look into my crystal ball, which is very murky, obviously, the real fight's going to be at the state level. You know, and that's what our system is always supposed to have been. The states were supposed to retain most of the power, and the federal government was supposed to have just a little bit. Of course, that's all flipped now. But with the fiscal situation we find ourselves in, as the dollar becomes weaker, at some point the states are going to have to start saying, "Look, we're not going to do that anymore." And you can't make us, you can't bribe us with dollars because they're worthless. We're going to figure some of these things out on our own. And that's actually a very good thing. It's something that should have happened a long time ago. But I really believe that the fight will be at the state level over the next however many years.
It's a great way to wrap this up, because that's certainly the philosophy of the Free State Project. They're taking their state back. They're building it from the ground up.
Yeah.
It sounds like you agree with that.
Yeah, and some of the things they're doing are things that folks wouldn't think about, but and we did this in Tennessee now. You know, they took the sales tax off of gold and silver coins, right? And then also, I believe that gold and silver are now legal tendering in Tennessee. So, you know, you can pay taxes in gold and silver, which for better or for worse, but what that does is that kind of legitimizes what has always been money throughout history. You know, we also prohibited basically government-issued digital currency in Tennessee. You know, so those are things that I think that states are going to have to start thinking about as well, is how do you shore up your own fiscal well-being by looking at even Bitcoin, just alternatives to, sadly, you know, the dollar, which not that long ago was still very sound, but moving forward, you know, what's going to happen, and how do you protect yourself, and how do you kind of insulate yourself from a systemic shock, which could be coming?
Yeah. Okay. I know you got to get going, but thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks for watching. If you liked the conversation, make sure to like the video, subscribe, and also ring the bell for notifications. And if you want to know more about Free the People, go to freethepeople.org.